Hey everyone, this is Ksenia Montan and welcome to another episode of People of Marketing podcast. I'm the founder and CEO of Planable, the collaboration tool for social teams. And I launched this podcast to take a sneak peek into the lives of top marketers. Every week, we explore the story of their careers, the choices, mistakes, wins, and imperfections of their work life. Our guest today is Leland Mashmeyer, the Chief Creative Officer of Chobani. His reimagination of the Chobani brand was honored as Best of the Year and is considered one of the best of the last decade, being described as literally and absolutely perfect. His global reimaginations of Spotify and Instagram were each recognized as Best of the Year. For this accomplishment, he won recognition as Global 30 Under 30, Young Influencer, and Design Thinking Leader. His work has earned honors from every major global creative award show. Leland, thank you so much for joining me today on People of Marketing podcast. I'm very, very excited to chat with you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and the way I love to start this interview is just by walking a bit through your career and trying to connect the dots. So you're currently the Chief Creative and Strategy Officer at Chobani. And I want to take it very, very, you know, back to the early stage of your career. And my question is, what would you say was your first interaction with marketing? What got you into marketing and into, you know, the advertising and creative world in the first place?
Like with so many things, one's first interaction is probably an interaction that one didn't understand was as such until much later when you give a name to it. So I grew up being a young artist. I loved drawing. I loved painting, all that type of stuff. And my parents really encouraged it. And one of the things that I loved to do was to take baseball team identities and reimagine them. I was doing this like in sixth grade, seventh grade, whatever. I would do the same thing with CD jewel case covers and stuff. At the time, I only really understood that as drawing. I literally had no language to describe that other than the language that I had existed with. It was art. It wasn't until much later in high school when I was starting to think about like where I wanted to go for college and why that someone introduced me to the world of marketing and framed it as kind of the space where creativity and business overlap. And that was very intriguing to me. So that was really the first time I came across the name or the word marketing and understood it. But I think my experience was much earlier in sort of the brand identity and visual communication element of marketing.
Right. And I'm curious, you know, walk us a bit through your career. How did you get started? What did you study? What was the journey? A quick summary on it, if you can.
I have kind of a random, disjointed journey. So in college, I freelanced as a graphic designer and what I would later come to understand was called service design. But I studied advertising in college and became fascinated with the strategy side of advertising because, again, it's kind of the creative and the analytical side of my brain. After college, I wanted to go work in advertising because it didn't feel like a purely artistic pursuit. I liked that combination of analytical and imaginative. And just having a career in graphic design or a career as an artist were not paths that offered that. And that was just based on my understanding at the time. So the problem that I had was you could not get a job in advertising until you got a portfolio put together at one of the portfolio schools. And I had just gone through 4 years of college and I was not interested in doing another 2 years of college and paying, you know, $40,000 to have a portfolio so I could get my first job. So instead I freelanced for a little while and did some interviewing for a bit and eventually was offered a position as a junior strategist at an ad agency. So I took that, liked it for a short bit, but then kind of became quickly bored with it. And I found myself gravitating much more to the creative department than the strategy department. The strategy department was run a bit like a research organization where you just look at the data and the data tells you what to kind of put into the creative brief and stuff. And none of the creative teams liked that. And I understood why they didn't like that. So I spent most of my time kind of building relationships with them. And then in the shadows was actually doing a lot of campaign work with them. I wasn't getting credit for it. They were teaching some of the older leaders in the creative leaders in the organization, recognized my effort and were kind of teaching me, you know, and helping me do the work, in the shadows. But more importantly, I really felt like there was no one within the organization I could have the kind of robust dimensional conversations that I wanted to have. So I started a blog, and this was like 2004, like when blogs were still kind of a big thing, particularly in the ad industry.
Yeah.
So my blog just became this repository for all these things I was thinking and these ideas I had and these dialectical debates that I was having just with myself. And it was just like, I just threw it on the web for other people to read if they happened to bump into it. The blog became fairly well known with just in the marketing community. It wasn't like a breakthrough hit or anything, but you know, people followed it and read it and knew about me before they ever knew me. But the beautiful thing about that experience of challenging myself to form ideas and philosophies and viewpoints was that I actually discovered what design was. It was not the applied arts as it was communicated to me earlier in my life, which was of no interest to me, even though I loved the creative aspect of it. Design, I really understood as a capital D, was the creation of intentional change. It sat in that intersection between the imaginative and the analytical, or as IDEO might say, what is desirable, feasible, and viable. I love that. And I really recognize that I'm a designer through my own internal learning process. And then it just became a question of, okay, well, where am I going to go do this professionally? Because I've been doing it either for fun or for freelance for a long time. And I called it different things. Either when I was younger, I called it art, or when I was older and doing it, I called it branding, brand strategy. So through the blog, I met my future business partner, Brian Collins, who essentially just said, hey, next time you're in New York, I'd love to meet you. So of course I came up with some excuse to fly to New York, and he and I had breakfast. And what was supposed to be an hour long breakfast turned into 3 hours. And at the end of it, he said, I've been thinking about, you know, leaving the ad agency that I'm at and starting a new design firm. But I wasn't sure if I wanted to do it until I met you. I want to start a new design firm with you. I want you to be my co-founder. So there's more to that story, but the short is 6 months later, we had the agency, the design firm up and running in New York City. I moved to New York, did that for about 10 years, and then got the call from Chobani to become their CCO. And the opportunity was really interesting because it wasn't just the opportunity to be a CCO. It was an opportunity to figure out how design and creativity can help an organization transform into a modern food company. And so that's what we've been doing over the last 4 years, and it's been a fantastic experience and a truly unique and once in a lifetime experience, which is why I felt I had to take it versus continue to stay at the design firm that I co-founded.
How was the transition overall from, you know, something that you created from scratch, you know, your baby, to something else? How did you find, you know, the feeling of ownership, and how was the transition overall for you?
You know, it's funny when you run your own design firm or your own ad agency, you know, really it's the clients that run it.
Yeah, know? That's true.
So you're never in full ownership of your company. So, you know, it was never really that big of a transition in terms of, responsibility, authority, and autonomy. It still felt kind of the same. I think what was different though was the dynamics of working inside a manufacturing organization are different than the dynamics of working inside a creative, business. The other thing is that there's just so much stuff that goes on inside client organizations that when you're on the agency side, for your whole career, you are ignorant to. You just don't know. And the more I learned about the experience of being a client, how client organizations run, how things are prioritized, all that stuff, the more I realized like how naive I was in a lot of the things when I was running my own firm that I was recommending. I was making connections between things business-wise that weren't really there. I was having assumptions that weren't actually true. I just didn't fully understand the real needs and wants and what creates value for a client. And I do now, and I consider it incredibly valuable. It has absolutely made me a better creative mind and leader knowing this side of the coin.
Yeah. What was something that you didn't expect at Chobani when you moved there? Something that like totally surprised you?
I think what truly surprised me was how, like, I'll keep it a little selfish. So what truly surprised me was I thought, okay, I imagine, and of all the things I can imagine myself doing when I get to Chobani, if I can do 70% of those things, I will be very happy, right? But once I got to Chobani, and once we started doing stuff, and I'm like 6, 7, 8 months, a year and a half in, I look back and I'm like, oh my God, I haven't done 70%. I've done like 150%. I've done way more than I ever thought I was going to do or be able to do or get involved with within this organization. Because a lot of times outside agencies kind of hold the superlative of being able to offer their creative talent the most diverse work experiences, where your work is constantly changing. And that when you go in-house, you're only working on the same brand and the same type of work over and over again. I found that to be a naive articulation of the difference between in-house and independent. Independent, yes, you work on lots of different brands, but you're kind of doing the same thing for each brand. Like right. If you work in an ad agency, you're making television commercials and outdoor billboards and activations and basically that type of stuff. When you're working in-house, yes, you're working on the same brand, but you are working on the entire ecosystem of the brand. You are touching things that outside agencies would never touch because of their positioning in the marketplace or the talent that they have. And you're also able to create briefs and take on briefs that never would have been given over to agencies because of service license agreements and limited scopes of work that those agencies have been charged with. So I have found being in-house to be incredibly diverse and rich creative experience.
That sounds all amazing, but I'm still curious if there's like anything that you're missing from the agency life.
Sure. I mean, there are aspects of the agency life where, you know, it is kind of cool to go and work with other organizations and see how they're working. I mean, certainly there were benefits to me running my own organization that were good and that I enjoyed. But, you know, it's not like one's better than the other. It's just a matter of like where a person is in their career, which set of offerings and challenges from each side of the coin is most attractive to you in that point in your career. And for where I am right now, in-house is incredibly fulfilling, both creatively and personally and professionally. And you know, maybe in the future, going back to agency will be something that aligns with what I want. But I don't for right now, I don't really miss anything.
Right. Something that I'm looking at your LinkedIn profile right now while we talk, and it's very impressive. Your description is extremely impressive. The list of awards and you know, you've been honored in so many programs and articles, and it's super, super impressive. And I wanted to ask you if there's any, you know, obviously so many projects that you've been awarded for, but I'm curious if you have one that really stood out for you, one that you know, remember most enjoyably. There's one that you'd love to highlight for us.
Oh man, you know, this is always one. This is always the question where you're asked to pick your favorite baby.
Sorry.
You know, they all have special places, but I'll pick one specifically because it's recent and probably a little less well known. We've always been an organization that has emphasized actions before words. And in top of that, that means investing in the communities in which we exist, because we want to use food as a force of good in the world. And whatever good can come of the food or the profit we've made from our food, we are eager to take advantage of that. So one of the quiet systemic problems in the United States is childhood hunger. Something like 1 in 4 children in this country are food insecure, which means at some point in the week, they either can't afford or don't have access to a meal. And that number has grown because of COVID and some other issues with the government changing definitions of, you know, who is deserving of government assistance. So it's obviously when you start looking at, you know, some of these images and some of the data, it is just mind-boggling that our country can't take care of children, and that many of these children and these families are put in this position in the wealthiest industrialized nation in the world. Now, there's lots of systemic reasons for this. There's lots of systemic effects of this. The one that we learned about was lunch shaming. So schools, public schools in the United States are underfunded terribly. And they charge, as they do, students meals. And that's how they recoup a lot of the cost. Well, when a child can't pay, a lot of these schools allow the child to run up a tab. Eventually, the tab gets so big and hasn't been paid in so long that the school has no choice but to pursue payment for that tab. Now, this isn't just high schoolers. This is like first graders. And a lot of these families aren't able to pay this tab. And so the school is left in a very difficult situation where it's like, do we recover our budget or do we not? And many of these schools, because they are so underfunded, have decided we're going to recover our budget. And they have adopted a policy called lunch shaming. Now, that's not what they call it, but that's what it has been interpreted as in the public eye and publicly known as. It is aggressive public shaming tactics to guilt and shame children and families into paying off their lunch debt. This includes everything from taking a lunch from a child and throwing it in the trash in front of their entire school class, branding the students as too poor to pay by making them eat very specific sandwiches that single them out among their peers as people who can't pay. They stamp children with stamps that say haven't paid. They bar students from prom or dances or field trips. And some schools, districts have even gone so far as to send threatening letters to the parents saying that Child Protective Services are going to come and take their children away unless they pay the lunch debt. Now, it gets all the more painful when you see pictures of these children telling these stories. You see a first grader telling the story and she's crying. You see a story of a third grader talking about how this happened to their friend and that their friend just went in the corner and sat by themselves and cried because they were so embarrassed in the cafeteria. And it's just awful. And so we have been tracking this for a little bit and trying to figure out what to do. And we noticed that one of the largest student lunch debts was in Warwick, Rhode Island. And the Warwick school system had announced that it was going to start enacting collection efforts. And of course, the community rose up. Now, the other kind of compounding tragedy of all this is that none of this was making the national news. Like, this was a national problem, but it played out at the local level. So at best, it was in some Facebook groups and maybe quietly mentioned in a local newspaper. But it was a national outrage that parents were fighting quietly. And so what we wanted to do was we wanted to sort of hit two birds with one stone. We wanted to do something about the specific lunch shaming issue in Warwick, Rhode Island to see if we could help, but also bring national attention to it because of our brand and because of the platform and the history and the legacy of doing community work that we have. So we learned about this thing in Warwick, and within 3 hours, we put together the $70,000 to donate and give to the Warwick, Rhode Island School District to pay off the debt for all the low-income children who can't pay off their debt. And we had our founder put a message associated with that, doing a call to action of other companies. We put together a very fast and quick lobbying effort at the state and federal level, speaking to congressional staffers who are really the gatekeepers to the congressional representatives who give them information and policy opinion, to enact and create changes at the federal level that normalizes how childhood nutrition hunger is addressed at a national level, because there's like a patchwork of mainly ineffective efforts at the state level. And we had an incredible outpouring of response to that. There were companies who jumped on board. There were companies who amplified the message. There were individuals and local organizations in the community who were raising their own money. Young elementary students started putting up lemonade stands to raise money to pay off their schoolmates' lunch debts. Kids donated their allowances and stuff. It became a topic that reached the national media. It was on all the major news networks in multiple different ways. We tracked the volume. I mean, it was like triplicate increases in mentions online and reach because of the national media. And it became integrated into, at the time, the presidential candidates' platforms. And each of the candidates specifically spoke about lunch shaming and saying that as a key pillar of their policy is that they were going to enact laws that ensured that no child in this country goes hungry. Wow. So it was something that was both managed strategically. It was something that had a powerful creative message behind it and execution to it, but also had wide and deep impact in communities, and really surfaced something that needed to change, but without creativity and the right strategic timing and cadence of trying to create whatever groundswell we could, was never going to get the attention. And we were able to do that. And so I'm very, very proud of that and the team who worked on it.
That's such an impressive story. Thank you so much for sharing it. It's heartbreaking and sad, but at the same time, heartwarming a bit on how you guys approached it. Thank you for, you know, telling our audience about this. I want to go back to the early stages of your career, of your journey, and I want to talk a bit about what I call seemingly insignificant events. Or they seemed insignificant at that time in our lives. But then, you know, in time you realize that those events went on and changed our lives. And I'm curious if you had anything like that across your career, across your journey.
Oh man, tons.
one.
I love these little things. Certainly one is writing the blog.
Yeah.
I mean, that changed the trajectory of my career.
What was the, you know, insight? What was the motivator of, you know, like starting the blog, by the way?
I just had no one to talk to.
That's
no
a good,
one wanted
that's
to
a good
engage
reason.
Me in any type of level of conversation that I was interested in having. They were all, like everyone I worked with were wonderful people. I was just looking for a specific type of conversation and I wasn't finding it locally. So I needed to reach out on the internet.
Yeah, that's a good reason. Okay. So that one was the blog. What else?
So another one, it didn't feel insignificant at the time, but it ended in a bad way. So many years ago, I spent 4 years writing a book.
Okay.
I literally wrote the entire book. And it was a history of ideas book about two predominant metaphors that influence so much of the way our society thinks, which is the garden metaphor and the machine metaphor. It was a very difficult book to write. I'm very proud of and invested a lot of effort and personal time into doing it. But about the time when I was working on the third draft of it to refine it and also running my firm started taking off, and the firm started requiring much more serious commitment from me to turn it into something remarkable. And so I had a Sophie's Choice type of situation, something that was deeply important to me because I've always wanted to write a book, and but was probably going to be at best a niche book, and it was never going to make me any money. It was just a personal goal. And then something else where it was a goal of mine, but it was also going to make me a lot more money and, you know, allow me to, you know, thrive in society. So I had to make a call, and I obviously chose the design firm to focus all my attention on that. And so I quietly shut down my computer and moved the folders somewhere else on my hard drive and haven't opened them since. And I was really distraught for like a couple months because I had invested so much in it and had so many like kind of visions of what would happen when the thing got published and how it would feel and all that stuff to hold the printed hardbound book. And so it was a big, big moment of defeat for me. And I just kind of, you know, swept it into the dustbin of my history, thinking that, well, that was a waste of time. And what's so funny is that everything I wrote about in that book informed my leadership and my imaginative thinking within Chobani. I don't think I could have been as successful at Chobani had I not written that book.
Well, have you ever, you know, gotten back to it? Have you ever considered, you know, still publishing it?
I have. It requires much more editing to it. You know, if your first draft is always the worst thing you could ever write, and I'm on draft 4, that gives, and it's a very complex book to write, it gives you a sense of like how much work is still left to do on it. But there are other books that I have in my head that I think I can write much more quickly, could be much more successful. I mean, truly, this book that I wrote years ago would be a complete outlier to the machinery of my life. It would just be like a gear sitting off to the side. It wouldn't really plug into anything that I'm doing.
Yeah, makes sense. You know, on the same note, you know, I want to ask you about how do you feel about your entire career path? Like, have you ever imagined very early on where you're going to be, like that you are going to be where you are right now? Did you have any strategy to get where you are? Did you dream of getting here, or was it like very random?
I always wanted to be a CCO. That was always a goal of mine.
Okay.
So I passionately and firmly believe in the power and importance and centrality of creativity to business. And I have come, as many creative people do, encountered a lot of resistance along the way to that idea, because most businesses think creativity is an ornament that they hang on the more profitable parts of the business to make it look a little prettier. But I think it's the actual opposite. I think the machinery is what you hang on the creativity. I think that efficacy is more important than efficiency to any business. And it's something that I have intuitively felt, and I've kind of shifted a lot of my thinking and things that I've learned from my CCO experience more into that space. So my passion is evolving, but it's evolving not because I want to do something differently, but because I feel like I'm now expanding to the next larger sphere that creativity exists within. You know, Dan Barber, who is the world famous chef of Blue Hill Farms in New York City, had a Netflix episode on Chef's Table.
Yeah.
And one of the things that he said profoundly resonated with me. And there are quotes from the world of design from like Ilya Serenin that say the exact same thing, which Dan Barber said all he cared about was great taste. Like that, the only thing he ever wanted to do was make things that tasted really good. But every time he asked, well, how do you make things taste good? It bumped into another question. And that question was attached to not the sphere of cooking, but the sphere of food science. And then you ask, well, okay, well, you see another question sitting next to the question about food science, and you pursue that, and you realize now you're in agriculture. And then you see another question sitting next to that and you pursue that. Now you're in the archaeology of historic agricultural practices. And then you just keep chasing these questions because you're trying to find more answers to your original answer of taste. And all of a sudden you look up one day and you're in this world that's completely different than where you started. A world that you never ever thought you would be in, because all you considered yourself was a cook who loved to make things that taste delicious. And now all of a sudden you're in this terra incognita world, but because you kept an open and curious mind and you chased those questions like breadcrumbs, you've not only expanded your understanding of taste and what tastes good, but you now see these connections and these cascading effects interlinked that affect taste. And if you want to affect taste, you don't go to the recipe, you don't go to, you know, ingredients, you go to questions that are, and spheres of experience and knowledge that are far, far further out than you ever would have thought. And I've been having that exact same experience with creativity. All I've ever wanted to do was make beautiful things.
This actually takes me very well to my next question about, you know, you've talked a lot about self-development and kind of branching into different things that are not necessarily strictly connected to what you do. And this takes me to, you know, my next question about self-development, but more precisely about struggles and in improving yourself. And I'm curious, you know, we're never perfect, and I think you'll agree. And I'm curious what struggles in terms of like habits or skills do you have right now? What are you trying to improve in yourself that you're not, you know, completely satisfied with?
I'll give you a really honest answer.
Go ahead.
I feel like an absolute and complete failure in my career.
No way. That's impossible.
No, I do. And I'm not saying that because I'm proud of it. I'm not saying that to be provocative in this. I genuinely feel like a failure.
Wow.
Because along the way, I've learned so much and I've discovered so much about what I don't know. And there are so many things that excite me to do that I know I'll never get to do, or I can't do, or whatever, that the possibilities of what one could have done or achieved with their life outweigh epically what one has done with their life. It is comparing the Atlantic Ocean or the Pacific Ocean with a drop of water. And that's what it feels like. And so on one hand, one can interpret that as failure. On the other hand, one can humble themselves in front of the vastness of possibility and wrestle with that tension to self-reflect and learn. And that's where I am. That's what I struggle with. And, you know, that the ancient Aztecs had a philosophy, or maybe it's a morality, where they called it the slippery slopes, and that one walks along the apex of the mountain of life, and the slopes on the left side of you and the slopes on the right side of you are extremely slippery, and it is your task to walk down the middle of them and not fall off or slip off the left side or the right side. You'll walk and you'll slip to the left a little bit, you'll walk and slip to the left a little bit, but you always have to avoid the slippery slopes and maintain, you know, that walk along the middle. And that's, you know, I think that's what it feels like for me. And I think sometimes it's translated, unfortunately, into as you're slipping, as you're walking forward, it just translates into, you know, lack of achievement.
Yeah.
And so lack of achievement then quickly gets translated into failure. So it is a constant struggle for me to tamp down that feeling and then to invert it into a positive.
Right. I think that's such a human condition to never be fully 100% satisfied with, you know, what you have. And like, it's a positive at the same time, you know, the ambition of, and like the hunger of wanting to learn more. I have one last question before we wrap up with our rapid fire session. And my last question is about the industry a bit. you know, the advertising world is such a fast moving industry, but it also has so many new buzzwords and new trends every single week. And the question is, if you have like one, you know, buzzword or trend or popular thing in advertising today that you think is massively overrated or that you completely disagree with?
Brand.
Brand in general.
I hate that word.
How so?
It means nothing anymore.
Yeah, it was diluted, right? Yeah.
It's been co-opted into everything.
Yeah.
The teaching of brand, I think, is fundamentally wrong. It is taught as a pseudo-religious practice. It is treated as a reified object that exists in the world when it doesn't. It is more of a consensual hallucination than it is a real thing. And it has caused more misspending because of a misunderstanding of it than any other practice in business other than cost plus pricing.
That's a great answer. So moving forward, I have two fast questions to you. So rapid questions, rapid answers. And the first one is, worst advice you've ever received, if you remember one.
Oh, I know exactly.
Okay.
The worst advice I ever received was someone telling me to not, as I move up in my career, to stop trying to make things and focus more on building political capital.
Oh God, that's awful. Okay. Moving past it very fast. The second question is, if you wouldn't be doing what you're doing today, what else would you do?
I've been asked this before, but I don't remember. I would probably, I'd probably be an author of something.
Yeah, that sounds right to what we've had before in the conversation. Leland, thank you so much for, you know, just taking the time to share your story. It was such a lovely conversation, and I really appreciate you. You just shared the story of your career, and I loved every bit of it, all the advice and everything you've shared with us. Thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been an honor.
Yes, and for everyone else listening in, thank you for joining, and I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I enjoyed chatting with Leland. And don't forget, we have new episodes every Wednesday. Subscribe to People of Marketing on your favorite podcast app, and till next time.